Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators Present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Washboard Resonators Present. And this week, we've got somebody who I think is a really interesting person. This is a Scottish-based jazz singer and washboard player. This is somebody who I know has worked and lived abroad as a singer, has worked all over the world in places like Japan. I think she's a remarkable person, and I'm looking forward to finding out about it because I don't really know anything. We've just, you know, crossed paths a few times, haven't we, Jack?
Yeah, same. I don't know much about it. I think she plays a bit of ukulele and stuff as well. So let's say she could be a Scottish mix of us too.
Yeah, there we go.
This is horrible mix.
A terrible thing, washboard and ukulele. But no, she is, I think, a remarkable talent, a really remarkable person. And hey, I'm looking forward to listening to the chat and finding out all about her.
Here we go.
So here we are. We've got Ali with us. Hello, Ali.
Hello.
And you are moving flats today, so thank you for squeezing us in so we could do this. I know you've been moving house, haven't you, and stuff, so thank you for that. So look, when we do these podcasts, we just start at the very, very beginning. So we'd love to know, where were you born and in what year were you born? You don't have to, you know.
Well, I was born in Dundee.
So it was Dundee, yeah.
It was Dundee. So yeah, that's where I started out. And a lady has to keep her age a secret, especially when you get a bit older. So there's no year, but I'm still young.
Yes.
Ish. Yeah, Dundee was where it started.
Okay, so now I hear an accent. So I'm trying to remember what we talked about in that basement of that pub when you put a gig on for us. Are you American or part American, part American Scottish? What's the deal there?
It is the most long-winded and dull story, but basically
perfect for us on the podcast. Go for it.
Well, I am I'm an American citizen and I'm a British citizen. And the way that I became a citizen of the United States, I don't think it would happen today. I think it was a hell of a lot of luck that went into it. I was over there temporarily for a few months. Mm-hmm. And then it's very convoluted and long. I knew somebody who worked at the Scripps Research Institute, and I ended up talking to them and they were saying, well, you could probably get a job here. So I'm trying to make a very long story short. I ended up getting a work visa. Mm-hmm. And I believe it lasted 2 years. So, but I kept on being employed. So I had to keep going every 6 months before it expired. I had to go down to the home office in downtown San Diego and just queue up all day.
Okay. So the American thing comes probably a bit later then. So perhaps we need to backtrack a bit. So when did you start singing?
Well, my beginning story is a little different. So I left Scotland, I think, it was before I was 18.
Right,
I just turned 18. I had full legal capacity to bugger off, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had been doing art at that point. I'd started the sort of HND program, mm-hmm. having left high school a bit earlier. But in high school, I was singing and playing piano.
Right.
And it was all classical stuff back then.
Right.
And going back a little further than that, in primary school, I loved to sing. And I was always the one who was hauled up and put in the front to do the solos, to be the sort of the lead performer of a show. And the only bummer about that was I remember when I would be, if we were singing, multiple harmonies, they put me beside the sopranos when we were kids.
Yeah, right.
Because they knew that I would still stay on track and not be dissuaded by The Sopranos, which is what happens. And sometimes I felt lazy and I wouldn't sing, and they would always stop and go, Alison, you are not singing, because if you were singing, we would hear you above everybody else. So I've always had a very powerful voice.
Sounds that way. So you come from a musical family then?
Yes, I do. So my everyone in my family are musical. We all play something to probably not the best standard, but it's, you know, we all do. My little half-sister plays trumpet really well. My other sister plays piano. My brother might not have. I think he was a singer, but he didn't really do much for that. He was a very sciencey person. My mother played as well. My granny played piano and sang. My grandfather played fiddle. And they were all involved in sort of amateur operatics to some degree or other, including my uncle. Oh, my uncle's also, he's a drummer.
I mean, there was no choice by the sound of it with that start.
And yeah, that capability
In the school choir or whatever, that sounds like it could only go one way, this, couldn't it, really?
Well, kind of. It's kind of a very peculiar and eccentric family. There mostly are doctors in my family of some kind of other. My sister's a policewoman. So it's all very sort of, there's a lot of academia there. And I did start out originally doing art and then I went to academia. That's a whole other story. But the glamorous part comes in on my grandfather's side of the family. Dame Nelly Melba is my great-great auntie. So she's pretty big time opera. I mean, she was the opera singer really back. And of course, this is in sort of Bel Canto era with just on the tail end of Caruso. I mean, obviously, but that's a tale of the family, but it's pretty cool to be related to her.
I mean, yeah, that is. So it's funny because I'm not, I've been to three operas and fallen asleep at two of them. And but I've heard of that name, which is amazing. So
I'm trying to find a picture of her to show you because
please do. So for all the people listening on the podcast thing and all that, then you can also view these on YouTube and you might see Ali shows a picture shortly. But okay, so I mean, there's all this music, there's all this kind of, it sounds like very creative, very interesting. A lot of sort of like family get-togethers, family sing-alongs and things like that.
There was, but so back in the day, I forgot to mention my half-sister's father is an amazing pianist and he was a baritone singer. So we're going, this is mostly opera stuff that was going on. Sure. And he used to throw these huge parties and all the people who were in town, all the opera singers who were in town, they would be there hanging around the piano. He'd be playing and they'd all be singing. And I'd sneak out my bedroom and try and be a part and get told, get back to bed, you know. So
you really wanted to sort of be involved in all that kind of world then from what, you know, I presume is a very early age.
Hugely. I found the picture.
There we go. Here's the picture.
She's got darker hair. So my hair is not normally this.
My goodness me.
Can you see?
For anybody, I can see that. Now, obviously, I'll have to describe our listeners, but what we're looking at is a very glamorous black and white picture. Of a lady in a kind of beautiful, what would you call that, kind of like a flowing gown or something?
Yeah, well, she died in 1932.
No, she died in 32. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're going substantially back.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so let's move through. So before you go to America, which was, I think you said before you were 18. So did you have formal music lessons and things?
Yes.
Yeah.
I had classical training.
So definitely full training. So you did your grades and all that kind of stuff?
I did. Yeah. I don't remember how far I got. I was playing piano too, and I just couldn't connect to the piano. I just had no love for it. And I was terrible because I'm an ear learner. Right. So they would make me do the sight reading and I would literally have a panic attack now that I know what those are. And I could play it really, really slowly. So I used to get into trouble a lot. So needless to say, I kind of left the piano behind.
Okay.
So
we're going through your youth. Are you into jazz before you go to America? Or does that happen there? Or has that happened before?
Well, I've always enjoyed it. My granny would talk about it with me.
Right. Okay.
Billie Holiday and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there's a song, and also the song by Mavis Staples. So my granny was fluent in French and German, and then she got by in Italian, got by in Polish. You know, she's a wow. one of these polyglots.
Oh yeah.
She would sing "Bimme Bist du Schön" in Yiddish, I believe, which is very close to German, and in French. And then she'd go, "Oh, it means this," and you know. So I got a lot of love of jazz from her, but it wasn't until I was in the US. Well, actually, mind you, saying that, I found my old tape collection, and there was a heck of a lot of jazz in there. So, you know, your standards, Peggy Lee, you know, Billy, but there was some obscure, Sophie Tucker was one of the obscure ones. And I think that came from my granny.
Cool.
And I've got some old vinyl from back then. And again, there was a lot of jazz in there. And some Bessie Smith. Now, I got into Bessie Smith because of the actor... Was it Michael Gambon?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know. I was very young and he was talking, someone was interviewing him and they said, "What were you listening to in the green room?" I think they maybe just said backstage. And he said, "Oh, it's probably a lady you've not heard of, Bessie Smith." And at that time I was absorbing my stepfather's music collection, my brother's. So I got all these really bizarre tastes. From my brother, I got like Queen and then I tried to please him by trying to like Iron Maiden. I remember that. But it was just to show my brother, "Oh, you're so cool." My sister's father had excellent taste. There was a lot of jazz, a lot of opera in there. And then this obscure name from Michael Gambon, who I thought was a pretty cool guy. He came across as a pretty funny guy. And I managed to find a cassette on her, and I thought she was great. At first, I didn't understand. I was like, "What is this?" You know, it's very hard to understand, but I totally started getting into that too. But in America, I started, in San Diego at the time, there was quite a big rockabilly scene.
So what took you to San Diego then?
Well, the reason I decided to go there originally was where my boyfriend was from.
Ah, it's one of those jobs.
It's one of those, yeah.
You followed a boy across the
Atlantic. I did. He's a hippie he was a skateboarder guy with long hair.
Dreamy.
Oh, yeah. His mother was Dundonian, so, you know, he was living in, you know, it's kind of a funny story, really.
I mean, I could have almost put that in a sealed envelope. That's okay, one of those jobs.
I wanted to ask, Ali, so you were having classical lessons, so were you having singing lessons as well, or just piano?
Oh, yeah, singing, absolutely.
So did you want to pursue a career in music or weren't sure? You said you wanted to do art, so was this before you did? You just thought, "Oh, well, you know, still young, let's go to America for a bit," you know?
It was both, to be honest. I loved the singing and I loved the singing lessons. I loved it. But I think I didn't have a huge amount of confidence, which obviously we can all relate to that. And I was consistently winning awards for my art, my fine art.
Right.
What kind of art? I don't know much about art, but put it in layman's terms.
It was just, I was doing a lot of portraiture at the time, and that, I seemed to be quite good at that. It's quite funny because I'm going back into that now as well in a way, but I don't know why. I was probably just too busy enjoying life at the time that I wasn't really thinking so clearly about this could actually be a career.
Yeah.
You know.
So you get to San Diego, and you follow your boy, and what are you doing over there then? How are you making ends meet? Are you living in a commune? What's happening?
We're going back into Ali the hippie Affleck.
Well, we want to see how this amazing, you know, jazz singer kind of develops, you know, the blooming of where that comes from. So, and the experience of who you are. So tell us about San Diego.
Well, it's wonderful, actually. It makes me go back to a very happy place.
Oh, wonderful.
So I was living, obviously, I was living with my boyfriend and his sister.
Right.
And in a wonderful place called Hillcrest in San Diego, which was actually the, it's kind of like the Soho of San Diego.
Right.
So a large gay population there. So, it was wonderful. Great music, great food, just a really safe place to be. And I was working in a shop. I was just doing anything I could to make ends meet while I was also, what I discovered at this point was that back in those days, the community colleges, you could go and do a semester of something. And you did, so I was suddenly presented with all these options to try things. like psychology, cultural anthropology, different art forms that were separated, different musical things that were separated out. So I just went mad and started doing all these different things to explore, to see what I wanted to do really. And I met a wonderful couple of sisters who I'm still really close friends with, Lizzie and Felicia, and they're both musicians. So Lizzie, this is why America's really cool sometimes. Her mother's from Glasgow and her father was Cuban.
Wow.
Yeah.
And a heady mix.
Yeah. And I met her in the dark room of studying photography at City College in San Diego. And she heard my accent. She's like, oh my God, you're from Scotland. Because my mom's from Glasgow and all the, you know. So that's how we first became friends. She played banjo, five-string banjo, bluegrass. Yeah, she was amazing at that.
Her
sister played everything, strings, basically. Guitar, band, you know, all these things. So we used to have these great jam sessions. And at that time, I was playing something called a bowed psaltery.
I don't know what that is.
No, I don't know either.
Tell the listeners at home what a bird psaltery is.
It's an insane instrument. It sounds like a horror show. It's basically, you know, you get the plucked psaltery. You see them depicted in medieval art. It's like a looks like, hog nose is the one that kind of looks like that. And it's got strings. Yeah. It's like a harp.
Right,
you play it on your knee or you would play it like this. Right? So that's a psaltery. And they were designed to be played along with singing the psalms. So it's a religious instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And the bowed psaltery found this niche in the really old-timey folky community and the Appalachian community. And it's basically triangle, like a big cheese slice.
Yeah.
And I had a full one, and I can't remember how many strings that was, but I had the full-size one. Mm-hmm. And you would just sit on a table, or you could hold it. The strings were arranged in such a way that you could put a bow, not quite as big as a violin bow, but similar, in between the strings. So then you would get all the increments. So and it had all the sharps and flats were all there too. Mm-hmm. So it was basically, I think, two octaves of just set strings that you would bow up and down between the. Yeah. It's a cool instrument. I have no idea.
I've seen those. So you're in San Diego. So did you take that instrument with you, or did you buy it there?
No, I bought it there. Dude, you got to understand. So we're talking in the 90s here, right? Oof. You could get anything in California, anything. Compared to, you know what I mean? Dundee.
San Diego, I mean, you're on the Mexican border practically, aren't you? So there's probably all kinds of craziness going on. I bet. So are you performing in some of these, like, the nights, the bars, the hootenannies, as they call them, the open mic nights? Are you doing any of that? Are you doing Scottish folk stuff or jazz stuff or what?
Well, obviously, when I was first there, I was underage, because you've got to be 21.
You're 21, and you said you were pre-18.
I was 18 at that point.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So,
goodness gracious.
I would hang out with, you know, Felicity and her family. They were all musical, and we would do some jamming. And then I met other people along the way who also played. And we would sometimes be down at the beach, make a bonfire and have a jam session. Inevitably, it was Scottish and Irish stuff.
Yeah.
And then there was a bit of Neil Young and sort of standard hippie stuff, like, you know, Joan Baez, you know.
Yeah.
When I got to 21, there was this whole other dimension. And I met, my friend had moved into an apartment complex called Vogue Manor. We used to call it Vague Manor because it was full of some real dopes. But it was a very weird coincidence. I basically am friends with a lot of the people to this day that lived in that apartment complex. One of them, Aaron, as ginger can be, Scottish, totally through and through. He played snare.
Right.
So he played Scottish music. And his flatmate, the guy who lived opposite him, called Ben, played the bagpipes.
Of course he did.
No way.
Yes. And they used to go busking in Ocean Beach. And the first time I met them, I was drunk as a skunk. I was like dancing, right? And they're like, what are you doing? Because, well, I'm Scottish. He goes, no, you're not. And I got into this big fight. Yeah, I'm Scottish and all this stuff. So, and then to find out that they lived in the same complex as my friend of all places in San Diego was crazy. So those guys were really cool. Then I met a guy called Joe McCaskill, who I'm still friends with, and he plays in originals and folky type band. Mm-hmm. And I start singing in his band. And I still remember some of the songs that he used to sing, his originals. They were funny as hell.
Where do you go from here then? Like, you know, how long do you live in San Diego for? Because I know you said that you lived in New Orleans for a while as well. So how do we get to that point? What happens in between New Orleans and San Diego?
Well, that's kind of the least exciting part, actually, because I wasn't
really.
Yeah, believe it or not. I mean, San Diego is the best part. I mean,
what is it about San Diego then that particularly lights you?
It was more to do with what I was doing at the time. I was just kind of involved. I was meeting all kinds of people and starting out. Everything was really fresh and new, really. And I sang in the Old Sod. That was an Irish pub, obviously. Hence the name.
Cool.
The
Old Sod. Definitely.
Met various people, sang a lot of Irish stuff out there. But anyway, I then got into rockabilly.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. This actually sort of brings me to the beginning of the going back to the jazz thing, really.
Of course it does, yeah, because it's so interconnected. Yeah. So what happens to get into rockabilly? Is it another boy or what happens?
No, it was going into a place called Tio Leo's in Mission Valley. So at this point, I had actually managed to buy a 1963 Mercedes 220. Yeah.
All right.
And but let me wait to hear how little it cost me.
Go on.
$1,000.
Wow.
And it was mint because the guy I was dating at this time, oh my God, this is like such a... He worked for a florist called Stan in La Jolla. And Stan and his partner had two cars already. And one day I went down there to, you know, meet my boyfriend after work. And I saw this car, this gorgeous car, you know, with little tail fins, beautiful. And I was like, wow. And I walked in and goes, wow, that's some car. And Stan's like, do you want to buy it? I was like, oh, I couldn't afford it. It goes, no, it's a pain in the backside. $1,000. And I was like, okay. And so, cause he had to keep starting it up. And cause you know, it was an extra car. It sat in his garage and it was a family car from the beginning. So it was absolutely perfect. Leather interiors and with the springs. So you're riding along and it kind of bounces. Oh man, that was some car. I will never forget that car. I adored it.
So you're driving around San Diego in this vintage Mercedes. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, you must have stood out. Lots of people on the scene must have known exactly who you were.
That's it.
The stylish Scottish girl.
Yeah, this is where the rockabilly thing comes in. So I lived in Ocean Beach at the time, and I used to go and wash the car the weekends. You know, you got a car that good, you got to look after that thing. You know, definitely, polish the chrome, and there was two other 220S Mercedes owners who lived in San Diego. One of them was cream colored and one of them was cherry red. So mine was dark gray. So we would wave at each other when we saw each other, you know. And one of them was a rockabilly person. And we just had a chitty chat. I think it was at a 7-Eleven and mentioned Tio Leo's. So Tio Leo's I went to. I thought that sounds interesting. They were all dressed up in the they were kind of mod sort of 60s looking folk. And at this point, I was sort of in a 50s phase anyway. I was wearing tons of 50s clothes because you could pick that stuff up for pennies.
Yeah,
over there. Because people weren't doing, you know, this old fashioned thrift store thing and the old timey clothes. Nobody went to the thrift stores, you know? No. So anyway, that was where the rockabilly thing started. A band called Hot Rod Lincoln were playing. And they were actually produced by Lee Rocker. Remember from Lee Rocker from the Clash?
From the Stray Cats.
The Stray Cats, right, yes.
He's the bass player.
You're taking me right down a bunch of rabbit holes. I love it. Yeah, so me and my pal loved it. Me and my pal Amy, she lives in Boston. I still know her. So we both really got into that scene and I started doing the victory rolls and we used to do all that. I used to drive, pull up in my big 63. Okay, it's a decade later than it ideally would have been, but it still looked pretty class. Parked
still
up high,
cool,
you know.
That.
Yeah, by all the choppers and hot rods, it still looked pretty damn good.
This is awesome.
Yeah, so I was in that scene, and then.
Do you do any performing now, or are you just like a member of it? You know.
Well, I wasn't singing it at the time. I did sing. I did start to sing rockabilly stuff. Not that it wasn't all the time though, because I was still working my tail off and studying. So it was very hard to.
What were you studying now?
I was still doing, I believe I was still doing art at that point and arty things and psychology, and I was still playing a little bit, but nothing too hardcore. I was just having a great time. It was California, yeah. Man.
Being in California at that age with that car.
Yeah.
And that just sounds, it's like, I think, if anybody could spend their 20s anywhere, there's probably few places in the world better, I would imagine.
Yeah. And it's not like that anymore. I lived in Ocean Beach.
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
And this is where the New Orleans connection comes in too, because I lived with an Irish guy, and I met him because I used to study Arabic. I was studying Arabic at this time. I just thought, this is a really cool looking language. I didn't, my grandfather spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and I thought that'd be really cool. And they offered a semester. So it's 3 months. Yeah. What am I going to lose? So
yeah.
I met a girl called Karen in my class, and she lived with Rudy, who was to become my flatmate when she moved out of state. And he and Paula, after some time after I moved out, they moved to New Orleans. So that's where that bit comes in. That's why I ended up with that. But I also, just sticking with the rockabilly thing a little bit longer, I used to work for a company called Surf Dog Records, where I would just do PA rap, running around like a rat stuff. And Brian Setzer is their main act on their label. And I met him a couple of times, a really nice cat. He used to perform, and he still performs in Encinitas. I think he still lives. I think he still lives in Carlsbad. But
does he live down there?
He did when I was there. Yeah, with his Cadillacs. But I used to get keys cut from and all that kind of just running around stuff. But he performs at the Del Mar Fair, and he still does. And that's kind of one of the big festivals. Also at the Belly Up Tavern.
We're going through your 20s. It sounds like you're learning all kinds of interesting stuff. So how do we kind of move on? Like, what happens as you get into like this New Orleans thing? What when does that happen?
Yeah, that was kind of a sort of changing point. I mean, there's so much happened in succession.
Yeah, of course.
When I was in New Orleans, it was way before Katrina. I think it was about 2000 maybe.
It's 2005, I think, Katrina, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was there probably 2000, I think. Yeah. I was going a bit wild at that point as well, because my boyfriend, when I was going to come back to the UK. This is where things are weird. I was going to go back to Glasgow to retake my higher grades.
Right. Okay. So you're going to do your school.
That's super interesting though, because you've just been doing loads of studying. Did you feel like you didn't achieve something back in Scotland?
It was very calculated. So I had, at this point, I now have an art degree. I then, for some reason, I don't know how it happened. Oh, no, I do know how it happened. I was doing volunteer work for the Feral Cat Coalition, and I was working as a front desk girl at Bay Park Pet Clinic as a veterinary nurse, because I'd also been studying aspects of that. And I know it sounds kind of crazy, but see over there, you need to have a job that gives you health insurance, or you're up, right? So how do you get that? A lot of retail jobs don't give you health insurance. The jobs that do are places like front desk girls, in clinics, dental assistants, medical stuff. So it made sense for me to be able to go and do that. And so I did. And I don't know how, but I ended up assisting him with the animals at one point, Dr. Roper, his name was. And he said, if you ever thought about studying veterinary medicine, because I used to ask him questions all the time. And of course, my family are all doctors. Sure. And I do have, I did take my sciences as well, not to a higher grade level, but I did enjoy sciences too. So he goes, if you ever thought about doing veterinary medicine, I would write you a reference. And I thought, So what I decided was, and again, this was probably partially me trying to prove something to my dad. I'm old enough to recognize that now, because he's a doctor. My brother's a doctor. My grandfather on his side was a psychiatrist. And I thought, I could do this too. So I said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to study veterinary medicine. So I took courses at Cal State San Marcos, I believe it was, for a pre-veterinary, pre-medical degree. So I then thought, once I decided to do this, I committed myself to it. And then I, the music took a back burner. And having spoken to various schools, I discovered that the easiest way for me and the quickest way for me to do this was to combine British qualifications with American ones. Otherwise, I would have to go and redo like 3 years worth of stuff. I thought, hell no, I can't afford that and I can't be bothered. So that therein, back to Scotland, redo my higher grade, the sciences.
Yeah.
Then I can then apply, then I can go in with the half and half. And it was an American university in the Caribbean that I applied for and was accepted to.
Wow.
My story is incredible.
You are probably the most bohemian person we've had on this series so far. This is amazing.
Yeah, it's a bit mad, but it's been great fun, and I'm delighted I did it because I know so much about so many different things now. But
right, so did you end up in the Caribbean before New Orleans?
No, that was after.
Right, so you go to New Orleans, and are you singing it there, or what's happening there?
No, a little bit, but just sitting in occasionally because I was. You know, at this point, I'm thinking, no, my future is in
veterinary
medicine.
Right.
So, but at that time, and I often try to remember this, when I was there on Frenchman Street, there was the Spotted Cat, Snug Harbor, and I think that was about it. It was nothing like today. Those two stick out.
You're in New Orleans around 2000.
Yeah.
And it's not the New Orleans now in 2021, which is there's a lot of history and culture there. Of course there is, but it's just a place where a lot of young Americans go on like spring break and get wasted as well.
Yeah.
You know, as well as loads of tourists listen to jazz and some good kind of places. So for you, as somebody who obviously has an interest in jazz and traditional music, did you manage to hear much? Were there any particular bands that you like to follow?
I can tell you.
Did it have a formative effect on you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I'd forgotten to mention that I went to see the Squirrel Nut Zippers, right?
Yes, I've got some of their CDs in the Eaves. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Actually, I believe a couple of them live in New Orleans and that I did see them there. I was like, what is this dance people are dancing to? What is this music? What is this dancing? And I started to learn Lindy Hop and then from there, Babo. So I'd already started to really get into it. I took loads of swing dance lessons, tons, like far too many to be so crap at it still. Do you know?
And that all links in with the rockabilly thing to a degree, doesn't it? That you see that a lot. Okay, so this all kind of makes sense. And then New Orleans is such a seductive kind of place in terms of its ambience, the humidity and the warmth. I can see why you might fall under the spell of that music.
Yeah, and of course, my friend Rudy and Paula are now over there too.
Yeah, so they've gone there. So were you studying in New Orleans then, and were you working as well?
No, it was just grunt work, the usual grunt work in a clothing shop. I don't think any of this stuff even exists anymore. It's a completely different place. But the band that I always went to see was the New Orleans Jazz Vipers. Mm-hmm. And they're still around today. But of course, Lillian Boutte, John Boutte, these guys are extraordinary. I mean, I adore Lillian Boutte. I mean, she's absolutely extraordinary. If you've ever met her, I mean, she's very unwell now, unfortunately, but she's the one person I would get tongue-tied around. I didn't because I adore her. Tiny wee lady, the nicest, warmest, most generous person. And the way she delivered a song is extraordinary.
So is it around this time that the jazz is taking hold to a degree?
Well, you're studying veterinary, aren't you?
I'm about to. Here's the next jump of the story.
She's about to go back to Glasgow to get her.
Yeah. I go back to Glasgow for a year. I redid my high grades, did that successfully, got accepted to Grenada.
As you do.
Started studying there.
I love the idea that you have to go to the Caribbean to study veterinary practice. It's amazing.
Why not?
So tell us about Grenada. What happened? Grenada
was great. I wasn't there terribly long. I was only there for, was it about a year, I think? Hurricane Ivan came along, and that's how that ended, because Hurricane Ivan came along, wiped out the school, basically. I'm making a really incredible story very short. I ended up going to stay with my friend in Barbados for a while.
Were you there when the hurricane hit?
Oh, yeah. I could talk at length about that. It's a long story. The I was there when the actual eye of the hurricane went over Grenada.
Wow.
So the whole, and Grenada's teeny. You can actually see it on a map. It's like, you could see Hurricane Ivan, the eye, and Grenada right in the middle. It went right across it. And one of the selling points that the university used to have was, we are outside of the hurricane belt. In 50 years, we haven't had a hurricane hit. The year I go there is the year it gets hit.
It's your fault.
Yeah, it was my fault. But there's, I mean, that's a huge story in itself, being on the island with no electricity for, you know, it was almost got to Lord of the Flies, but not quite.
Wow.
So were you enjoying studying to be a vet?
No.
Did you? No. Right. Okay. that's a very simple, straightforward answer. So at what point did you realise then, was there any kind of internal struggle with, oh, I better see this through because my parents are watching and I've been messing about for a long time and I'm going to do this? Or was there a point where one day just the penny dropped and you're like, you stopped the plate spinning, said, I'm going to let it go, forget it.
And remember, I've taken out loans to do this as well.
Yeah, you're massively in debt.
Yeah, at that point, just as 20,000 in debt, maybe.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But
hopefully, it could have been more if you got a lot of money for your Mercedes. That's great.
It would have been I would have been taking out loans probably $200,000. Today it would be even more than that, but that's what I'd signed up to do. So when the hurricane came along, I was in Barbados staying with my friend, and every intention was to go back, right? But then the school wasn't going to be built, so I was on deferment. And the school, they were going to try and hold classes back in the US. So I eventually got sent back to the US. So I went back to California.
Right.
At that point, I reconnected with friends. I was doing a bit more music. Then I was working at the UCSD as a sort of in a slightly scientific role, sort of lab technician type work, hating that as well. But at that point, I met a man who I got engaged to.
Ooh, cool. Fantastic.
Yeah, didn't end up in any wedding, obviously, but
exciting, I'm sure
it was at the time for a little while. He didn't want me to go back, and I was like, okay, I'll stay with you. And then it gets exciting again because we moved to Germany.
What?
Yeah, we moved to Germany.
What's wrong with Scotland, Ali?
Well, he got a job in Germany, and I was gonna run, and you know, I was with him, and I started to do a little bit of music there. I started to find, it was Heidelberg. There was so little going on. Well, actually Schriesheim, which is just about, it's outside of Heidelberg.
Yeah.
So I was trying to find other musicians, and I was trying to, you know, the swing dance scene is teeny there. Mm. Then things did not work out with him.
Have you given up on the veterinary? But at this point,
well, I still was told that if I wanted to go back, I could go back. I could totally jump right back in. But at this point, I thought, I don't know if I want to get $250,000 in debt.
Also, you're signing up for in Britain, it's like several years as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And I thought, I like this stuff, but I just thought there was just something that wasn't quite right.
Hmm. It just didn't fit with you for some reason.
So then I end up back over here.
All right. Okay. So where'd you come back to here then in Britain?
I came to Edinburgh. My thought being, right, if I'm going to be back in Scotland, it has to be Edinburgh. Edinburgh's beautiful. And I thought it's the capital. There'd be more stuff going on.
It's the best place. And so are we just to give some perspective, is this like early mid 2000s ish? When roughly?
I want to say 2006.
Okay. Because you were in...
I think
about 2006, you come back to Edinburgh. Okay.
I could be off there, but yeah.
So what happens when you land in Edinburgh then? Are you with your fiance now or not? Or what?
No.
Okay.
Ah, I like traveling too much for him. He's Texan, he wanted to settle down and have kids, and I, as much as I loved him and his family, we were looking off two different shores, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he used to get really upset when I performed.
Really?
Yeah, he didn't like it.
Really?
Yeah, he didn't. I don't know why, but and when I was swing dancing too, I remember he came and I was singing, and then in between the songs I danced, and the guy dipped me, and he was like, "You shouldn't. I don't want to see that." And
what?
He wasn't. He's He's very happy now in his life, but I was a little too wild for him. Mm. That's the bottom line.
Ooh. Isn't that interesting? Okay, one of them jobs. Okay. So, like a yo-yo, you go back to Scotland. And what happens in Scotland then? Is this when the jazz stuff starts taking off?
I was new in town. Now, I've lost touch with a lot of my Scottish friends, or I'd been out of touch for quite some time. So I thought, what do I do to make friends? And I thought, okay, I go swing dancing. And I find jazz places. And that's what I did. I found the Edinburgh Swing Dance Associations here. And Wiggum's just opened up. So that's where I started. Right. And then I was confronted with a whole new problem. Because I liked all the really old stuff. At this point, I listened to all the old stuff. Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, you know, Maxine Sullivan, all this stuff. So I go into the jam session and I asked to do, I think, Me, Myself, and I.
Yeah.
And one person, only the bass player knew it, Owen McDonald. And he knew it because Feather, his father, was part of the sort of 1980s trad jazz revival scene.
Yeah, yeah.
He's an old cat now, obviously. But he, Owen, grew up with this stuff. So with him, I said, right, this is what I want to do. I want to do all this really old stuff. This Bessie Smith, really, really old. And that's where it basically started. But I was kind of screwed because I was the only person, only woman, no, the only person under the age of 60 singing this stuff in Scotland. There was nobody else. There were a few trady bands, instrumental bands out there. And they were all, you know, they're quite old at this point, these guys. Then Fiona Duncan, of course, she was playing occasionally. She was obviously in the Clyde Valley Stompers, you know, through the 60s and whatnot.
I've seen her at a place,
Yeah, she's fab. She's amazing. Oh, she's a goddess. I love her. Yeah. And then, so then it was just me. So it was really bloody hard. I found it very hard to put a band together. Owen was in the band. As serendipity had it, Tom Davis showed up in Scotland about this time, and I'd gone to the jazz bar. Bill Kyle, of course, run the jazz bar. He didn't have any really any early jazz in there. He just didn't do it. But I'd gone down to the jam session, and this young guy was up there playing an absolute amazing guitar, and I thought, he's good. And I spoke to him at the end, and he was brand new in town. And I said, do you like old-timey stuff? And he's like, yeah, I love it. So I started my first band, Vieux Carré, which makes perfect sense to me, but then nobody could pronounce it, Vieux Carré. So I thought, I eventually had to ditch the name. But that's how I started doing the jazz here.
And so what was the lineup in that band then? Was it just you and the guitar, or did you bring other rhythm sections and front lines in and stuff?
Yeah, so it was myself, Tom Davis on guitar, Owen McDonald on bass, Dick Lee, he's a fabulous, an older gentleman on clarinet. He's still one of the best Reeds men in Scotland, absolutely. And I still work with him. He's still he's in my band, The Copper Cats. And Kevin Dorian was on drums. But Kevin's a much more modern player. And I found that as time went on, I started to get unhappy. Oh, yeah, Campbell Norman would join on piano sometimes. But I started to feel frustrated with the fact that it wasn't the sound I wanted. Do you know? It was, sometimes it was fine, but a lot of times it was an approximation. And I loved all the people I work with. But then I thought, you know, if I want to really do something with this, I need to try and build something from it. And then I ended up going, it's going to sound crazy. I went down to London. I worked for the BBC in London for a while. It was just, so this was in 2013.
So 2012. So what are you doing at the BBC? What are you working there?
I worked in the creative services department.
Yeah.
In Foley Street.
Right.
What made you want to do that?
Well, the opportunity popped up. It was an apprenticeship. And I thought, okay.
Right.
I might as well.
It's because you've been sat still for about 3 years and she couldn't take
it. I know. But I just thought, ask her, you know, I want to be in London. One of my friends from Egypt had relocated to London.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, it'd be cool, I'll go live there for 6 months to a year, you know?
So if we talk it, so I think, you know, there's something here that I can talk, you know, from personal experience, that there was a point, like you said, in the mid-2000s, where you didn't really meet many people that were into the old-time stuff, but there was the trad side of things, and then you didn't really meet people. And then I think now what's happened since post the internet and Facebook is these little groups can, like swing dancers and more traditional music people can sort of find each other, and it's like a little cottage industry that supports itself.
Yes.
It sounds like you really kind of came in early, and then going to London is probably a great place to see that and see the best players and meet the best players.
It was the best,
I would say.
Oh, I fell in love even more strongly. And it was when I was there that I decided this is what I'm going to do full time.
So it was in London in 2013. So this is interesting. So 2013, you've been in America in the 90s, whatever it was. But like you, it wasn't until 2013 when it really struck home.
Yeah,
I find that astonishing. Having seen you and met you, I would have guessed that you'd been doing it for 20 years or something. You've been the jazz singer, but it's actually relatively recently, actually. I think we all know it. Jack could say, I could say, there's a point where just something steely happens deep inside your heart. You go, I'm doing this and nothing's going to stop me. This is just everything. And it was 2013 in London for you, it sounds like. Okay.
Yeah, that was I said, no more compromising. I'm not going to run myself ragged trying to do things that aren't going to help me. I'm trying to think. So 2013. So then I came back up, and then I was going down, and I was doing a lot of the jam sessions at the jazz bar.
Yep.
I was performing various places. I was invited. Prior to this, in 2011 and 2012, I was working for Jazz Scotland as well as a volunteer. So, and I was at that point trying. Jazz Scotland being the biggest festival, jazz festival provider in Scotland. Yeah. So, and it was at that time I was actually given a gig by them. And that was a part of it was a big turning point for me as well. I started to perform at more and more places. And then I think 2014, I won the Best Jazz Vocalist Award in the Scottish Jazz Awards.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
So that, and I was also nominated my album, which was
this with the same. This was with the same band. I can't remember what you said the name was now.
Yo Carré. Yeah, the old Quarter. It was named after the old quarter in French Quarter. The old square is what it means. So I also self-produced an album with that band, and it was one of 12 shortlisted for Best Album of the Year. I knew it would never get in because it was up there with like Tommy Smith and all these, you know, but it may have just been people enjoyed it. So they popped it in and it was what it was. And I was nominated as Best Newcomer. And I, for some reason, I was also in the Best Vocalist category, and I won that award, and apparently it was a unanimous decision by the panel. So I was like, right, I really definitely want to keep doing this because it gave me a wee bit of
confidence.
Yeah, it did. Ooh. So now I find myself really wanting to assemble the best crew, the best to try and get the more authentic vibe. And I think it was around about this time that I approached Colin Steele, the trumpet player. I remember it well because he was playing at Le Monde and I'd gone down there to check it out. And I said, hey, how's it going? I was intimidated because he's Colin Steele. He's huge, huge, amazing player. You know, he's such a big star. And I mentioned it to him thinking he'd go, yeah, whatever. And he's like, no, I'd love that. That'd be great. Send me a message.
Wow.
And the rest is history. He's like my right-hand guy in my band's now. You know, he's like in all my. Yeah, I mean, I guess we're sort of in the present moment now.
Well, I want to talk about the Red Hot Rhythm Makers. Also, like, I remember when we met you in Edinburgh that time, you just, I didn't know this had happened, you just dropped in. Oh, yeah, I was just in Japan playing washboard and assembly. And I was like, what?
And where did washboard play into that? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I thought you played a bit of ukulele or something as well, didn't you?
I'm pretty crap at it, though.
So is everyone. Yeah.
Everybody is.
Yeah.
We just made the same joke. That's embarrassing, Martin.
Well, let me see. Yes, that's right. So in 2019, that was a really big year for me. I went over and I played, I was invited to go play some gigs in Japan. And I connected also with the Clap Song Swing guys, and we did a bunch of gigs together as well.
Where did that come from? Just the internet and finding an internet?
Yeah, we've been chatting, and we have some, I believe we have some mutual friends. And there's a Scottish girl who lives in Osaka, and two of the girls, well, they live in Osaka, apart from Ryohei, who lives in Tokyo. No, Kyoto. So that's where that came about. And then I was also in Germany as well, working with the Rufus Temple Orchestra, who are amazing. They're like my dream band, you know.
So that orchestra, so you like just brought in as like a vocalist.
Yeah, I did a little washboard when we went out as a trio. I did some washboard on that too, but I'm not a relaxed washboard player. I need to work.
Tell us about the washboard, because obviously that's, you know.
Yeah, I'll tell you while Jack's
one of our novelty things that we do. How does one get into playing washboard, Ali? Tell us. Like, is it that you really, really, really wanted to do it, or that you, just somebody said, "Hey, why don't you do that?" Because we need somebody to fill the sound out.
No, I wanted to do it. I really wanted to do it. I had a washboard. I had one in New Orleans. I actually have one at my friend's house in Ohio. Whenever I do gigs there, it's there for me. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
You do gigs. You just do gigs in Ohio, and you've got a strategic washboard, have you?
Yeah, no, for right, reals. Okay. For reals, it's there.
Just for Jack's sake. So how does one, learn washboard? Did you take lessons from drummers? Did you learn? Did you just play them to records? Like, what did you do?
Well, I did. I started taking classes from Cal McIntyre, who's an amazing drummer. But obviously COVID, kibox, all that. Can't do that right now. But I also took tips wherever I was. When I was in New Orleans, there was a guy called Washboard Chaz out there, and I asked his.
Yeah, we've looked at his videos on YouTube. He's got like instructional tutorials on YouTube and stuff. Yeah. So you met him and played with him, did you?
Yeah. And he goes, yes, I was so worried about it. He's like, there's no rules. You just play. And it's like, okay. Well. And then Dizzy from the Shake 'Em Up band, obviously I'd gone over there and I'd seen those girls play, and I said to them in 2017, I was like, look, I'm going to try and figure out how to get you guys over here. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because the next year I got them booked because I, you know, through Jazz Scotland. And I remember when I met them, I picked them up at the train station, and I goes, did you think I was talking crap? And they're like, yeah, lots of people say, because no, I make stuff happen, girl.
Yeah, I think you'd be perfect. Yeah, I mean, the amount of offers you've I'm sure had, just, yeah, you don't do this, yeah, sure, and it never happens. But yeah, you'd be perfect for that job in Scotland, knowing so many people, and like, you get hopefully very good players, but even just players from other countries, they make festivals exciting, and it gives, even if they're not necessarily amazing, they still bring a different angle to stuff.
Yes,
like it's always very interesting.
It's one of the beauties of jazz is that it is this kind of international language where people can get together and make art instantly, and it's a beautiful thing.
It really is. And to be honest with you, the fact that it wasn't easy for me because there were so few musicians who were into the music or playing the music, because I had to kind of try other people and all these different things, I think it was a good thing, because it's given me the courage and confidence to approach people and say, hey, you want to jam, or you want to do something? And it also means that I've been very open to helping other people who have good attitudes, and they're good at their music, and trying to help. It's a nice community. You know?
It is a nice community, and this is sort of how we met. Was I can't remember how it worked exactly, but I think we basically got an Instagram message off you. I think it was from you and from the Red Hot Rhythm Makers originally, but saying, if you're ever up in Scotland, let's do something.
Yes, that's
And then I was like, we're going to do something. And then when, you know, 3 months later, me and Jack are booking a tour, and I was like, right, I've got somebody in Scotland that has to do something. And what's interesting when you said about getting stuff done, you're somebody who stands out a million miles. You know, we deal with so many people in normal non-COVID times. You're somebody, if you say you're going to do something, it just happens instantly. And if you say you want something, you just do it, and it just gets done. And it's very rare that it's something you do.
Yes.
You're very good at it, and it's fantastic. You know, so we come in as a people who hadn't really played Edinburgh, and then we got to do a nice little gig, and you sorted it out for us. It was brilliant. So thank you for that. It's amazing humanitarian work thing that you're doing there, just to sort of go around the internet contacting weird, hairy men playing weird instruments, and yeah, saying come and play in a basement in a pub, and we'll sort it out. So thank you for. But yeah, so okay, so it sounds to me like there's so many things here that are just, I think, questions, like just general questions about the jazz world. So you were talking about just now about reaching out to people, because there isn't just this massive amount of people playing the style that you want, so it's taught you that. The Red Hot Rhythm Makers, do you still do that band? I mean, I know COVID's kind of destroyed us all, but like do you still do that?
Well, what happened was one of them moved to Norway and one moved up way up north.
Right.
Explain who the Red Hot Rhythm Makers are first before we see.
Yeah, it was basically, so I did my usual thing, which was, got in touch with people and saying, look, would you be interested in making a band with me? So I...
Well, just because I can't remember, I don't know what the timeline is, but you weren't 100% satisfied with this band you were playing in, right? So was this you trying to make, you know, grabbing the bull by the horns, really, and starting your own band and leading it, and this is what you decided to do?
Well, I mean, the bands that I work with, the Copper Cats, Bedlam Swing, and the Jim Mill Genies. So the Copper Cats are... tuba. There's a tuba in that band, a six-piece band with tuba, so that informs the choice of music. Bedlam Swing are a few of the same members but with double bass and guitar, so that, again, unique. That informs the songs. And the third band is the Jim Mill Genies with piano, and it can be double bass or it can be tuba, and again, that's the more bluesy stuff. So basically I thought, right, I've got such a massive repertoire because I just devour songs, that I thought I need to have different bands really to suit these different flavors. So Bedlam Swing, of course, will have more of a Billie Holiday vibe, probably a bit more classic swing, Maxine Sullivan, Mildred Bailey kind of thing. And as I mentioned, the Jim Mill Genies is a bit more bluesy and a bit rougher, a bit of Bessie Smith, a bit Filthy, Innuendo, yeah. Holcomb, all that stuff. I noticed you did the Filthy Blues thing the other day.
Yeah, I just released a video yesterday on the Washboard Resonators YouTube channel, which was the 10 yeah. rudest blues songs or some nonsense to do a weekly video while we're locked down. But yeah, thank you. It's so the Red Hot Rhythm Makers was an all female sort of trad, would that be fair to say, kind of outfit?
No, not really.
Wrong.
I wouldn't want to call it trad because it kind of became its own thing. Right. So we started out with sort of some trad songs, and we certainly do like Weary Blues and things like that. But then we were paying most of our attention was being paid to the early blues and early jazz singers, and a lot of innuendo, of course, in there because of the empowerment that it gives women. I mean, again, I could talk at length about that, but obviously that's for another time.
It's a question I was going to come to, which is about being a female in this world. I would love to know about that, but which is I guess where I'm going with this, but we'll contain it by the sound of what you're saying.
Yeah. So these girls hadn't obviously Danielle, so I'll be honest, this is what I did. I contacted a girl, I'd never met any of them before, got in touch with them. Are you up for it? Yeah, let's meet up. And then I said, there's obviously a big lack of good bass players, as there is anywhere. Bass and drums, good ones are hard to find. So I said to Danielle, look, I'm putting this group of girls together. And I was kind of just between us. I was using Danielle a wee bit as the canary in the gold mine here, because I already worked with her in the Copper Cats. And I thought, if she likes it, then we'll go for it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the session, you know, I spoke to her, what do you think? She goes, oh, it was great. I love it. So I thought, right, let's go for it. Now, the others were very new to this. They hadn't played jazz before and certainly not this type of jazz. So, but it progressed really well. I mean, it became its own thing. So we started to focus mostly on lots of multiple harmonies. For me, I wanted to vehicle a band where I could try and concentrate a bit more on percussion. So I thought, right, with these girls, I can play the percussion more. I can build my skill without feeling intimidated by you know, like the guys that I work with are such outstanding musicians, you know.
Yeah, Ross, sure.
I mean, Ross, Roy, Colin, and these guys are maestros. There's no question. Yeah. And I gingerly put the washboard on and go.
Yeah, and you know? No matter what you say, it is a washboard at the end of the day. So it's, you know,
it's a bit hokey, you know.
Not necessarily to be taken too seriously. Sorry, Jack.
It's
no offense there.
But it's true. So I thought, here's a space where we can all go together. Do you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you get to just play and sit in the group a bit, and it sounds almost punky in a kind of way. You put it together. You're just like, you look like you'll fit good. Let's do it, all girls. Let's go out there.
Yeah.
Sounds fun. It sounds like everything you've done in your life so far. It's got the same kind of tale, which you just do it and count the cost later. Like, let's just see what happens. And I think it's an amazing attitude. I mean, would you say that you're kind of fearless in that way, or is it not?
I guess I am, because I'm just, but don't get me wrong. I know the difference between a phenomenal player and someone who isn't phenomenal. But I do believe that it's important, particularly for women, to be able to feel and safe to have a go.
Yes. Sure.
So the right, we're going to be having a little get together in July at some point to chat about stuff and see what is feasible, what isn't.
Yeah.
Because people have moved in different places, and some of them are getting more involved in different types of work. And cool. I'm always someone who wants to be doing as much as I can, which is maybe easier for me than some of the other girls. So, but I've got another couple of, you know, some lovely ladies that I approached and said, do you want to try and do this? So I've got, these ladies are learning on the job again, so to speak, double bass, guitar, and reeds, this kind of music. So my idea is to try and encourage more women, and then make a kind of collective, even if it's just for fun.
Yeah.
It's important.
That's what came across when I first got that message off you, and I looked down your Instagram, and what I kind of got the feeling of was that the collective is exactly the right word. And now that you're saying that you just wanted to bring women in, even if they don't play, like, right, just learn it and then we'll do it together. I think that's a really beautiful thing, because you play at such a high level with these other people. This is something where it's much more like a grassroots encouragement.
Yeah.
Like, say, like a fun thing. And that's something you obviously feel is really important, is to give people, ladies, an opportunity, have a laugh, do something a bit different. So why is that? What is it about trying to perhaps open doors for ladies? Is it because you've had doors closed in your face, or you found it hard at times, or inappropriate behaviors, or what?
It's probably a whole psychology behind it. I think because I had to do everything myself, basically, which I think was a very good thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But also because in Scotland, particularly, the early jazz scene isn't really given as the same amount of respect, I think.
I'd say that's true in everywhere. It's
everywhere.
No, maybe not in London.
Yeah, well, you've lived and worked there. I mean, Jack, you've gigged there with a lot of the people.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's just, I don't know. It's my desire to connect with people, to meet good people. I don't know. But playing music is one of the most beautiful things you can do. It's sure. So mindful.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and I think maybe there's a part of me that thinks it is such a male-dominated art form. Yeah. And, you know, Molly from the Shake 'Em Up band, she said, you know, we talked quite a lot about this and when I was over there, and she was like, you know, it's almost like the women have to be better than the men in order to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
But I'm also the same way about ageism, because it's rife. Mm-hmm. And what's wrong with having an old cat playing in the band? I mean, when I was in Ireland, I was in Cork, and I believe the sax player was 82.
Yeah.
And he was great. And he was he had the best banter out of everybody, I'll tell you what. Mm. So there's a part of me also that wants to sort of push against that and just say, this is for everybody. I guess that's it. It's the old hippie in me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful thing. I think what we're seeing there, obviously, when you talk about the underdog, or it's almost like the veterinary thing again, isn't it? There's this kind of wanting to be of use and help, and probably get your hands to literally get your hands dirty to sort of make the situation better for people and for things. So it's there's a definite throughput there. That probably comes from sensitivity and empathy, you would think, by the sound of it.
I think so.
As mixed with a desire just to move forward and to have a vision, have a dream and make it happen, which is fun.
Yeah, hugely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and I always joke about being kind of Californian and Scottish. So I've got the California confidence and the Scottish Calvinism. So I've got the, go, girl, go. Oh, you can't do that. You can't do that. Don't you do that. And then, you know.
Again, that sounds almost like sort of a bipolar situation if you're talking about sunshiny California and Calvinism. You know, it's almost like a kind of a dour sense of what can and can't be done. I mean, that's interesting. So I mean, it sounds to me like the American experience has obviously changed you a lot. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Obviously, I mean, your life would be different, but do you think you would have been jazz singing without going to America, or would you feel like it still would have happened for different reasons?
I'm not sure. I really can't answer that, because if I had never gone to California, I wouldn't be anything like the person I am now. So I think, to be honest with you, the fact that I did that really set the stage for my entire life to just go and do stuff.
Yes.
And I think I obviously had something in me that made me want to do that to start off with. But second of all, the California attitude and sort of go get it, you can do it, that obviously made a difference to me. And I think I carry that definitely still to this day. But I think that gave me in Cuba, they say the huevos, which is the same thing as the cojones, right? You gotta have the huevos, the eggs, right?
Yeah.
To approach people and ask people if they're interested in, you know, maybe doing some gigs and whatnot. And of course, that led to me asking Enrico and you and Bleach and Joplin and all these cats.
Well, this is something that I was thinking about. Like, whenever things pop up on Facebook, don't they? And I said, oh, she's done something with Enrico Tomasso or whatever, who is the greatest. I mean, you've played with Enrico, haven't you, Jack, I think?
Yeah, several times. Yeah, he's like, he's UK's Louis, really, isn't he? In my opinion. But.
Yeah.
He does a trumpet thing, which is like a Louis Armstrong thing. And he met Louis Armstrong as a kid, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Which I think I'd love to talk to him one day.
We'll get him in. He's on the list.
He's an amazing guy, amazing to see and stuff. But yeah, so, I mean, there's nobody better in the United Kingdom. And you've performed with these people. That's why I thought you'd be amazing to talk to, because I knew there was an America kind of thing. I didn't realise just the length of it, but there's also this working and singing for for a living in this beautiful city and working with these top guys, cats. And to use the parlance, it's I don't know, what an interesting story. I mean, just what you burn bright, it's clear, isn't it? And it's amazing. And it's been amazing to hear all this stuff. So
what's your plans kind of after COVID now? What bands have you got going on?
Well, I just recorded with Rico and Ewan and Joplin, and it's a 9-piece band. And I took a big risk on this one because I did some really, really old songs, Sophie Tucker, a little mixed bag of things there. So that is going to be on the Edinburgh Jazz and Blues Festival on the 17th. There we go. July.
So Edinburgh Jazz Festival, 17th of July, 2021. Yeah. You're going to be there, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, it's recorded and it's going to be online.
Yeah. So people can get, presumably they can get tickets for that. Is that the way it works?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You just have hop on the website and it's Ali Affleck. I think it says, it's Ali Affleck and the Hot Town Tigers is what I've called the band.
Good name. That's a great name.
I had to come up with something, and I thought, Hot Town Tigers.
That's awesome. So we'll get that out before the 17th of July. And also, what else is going on with you before we just tie up the end here?
Yeah, well, I'm going to be hopping over back to California since the first time since 2015. So it's going to be quite a sentimental kind of journey for me.
Yeah.
So
gonna
I'm staying
take with some, a sentimental
journey. Yeah.
Somebody should write a song about that.
I have been writing original stuff, by the way. I just haven't put it out there yet. But I'm going to be over there for a wee while. And I've been speaking to a lovely lady, a lady banjo player.
Okay.
And some of the guys from the California Feet Warmers and Jonathan Stout. So we'll see what can happen. We've got to see.
There's nobody better at playing that kind of guitar than Jonathan Stout, I think.
Oh yeah, he's fabulous. So
I've lost a lot of hours on YouTube to watching him. He's amazing.
He is extraordinary. Yes, I really adore his playing. So
you're going over to California, which is amazing. So when's that then? Like here we are in
late July. I'm going to hop over. Gosh, that sounds so dick. And I'm going to hop over. I am internally grateful that I do have an American passport, so I can freely do that. Part of the thing, I am going to spend more time in the US from now on. Because I think I should really take advantage of that fact. So
that's definitely
happening. But I was luckily enough awarded a grant to do, to put into production a idea that I have for next year's Fringe, which is something I'm going to talk to you two about too.
Edinburgh Fringe, for just in case.
As an Edinburgh Fringe.
You want to talk to us about something? Well, that's perfectly brilliant.
Yeah, I think you would be perfect for this, but we'll talk about it at another point.
Yeah, okay, well, yeah. Okay, to be continued. Okay, that's fantastic. Yes. Okay. Well, you really do just like make things happen, and you obviously have this amazing love for it. It's been amazing to hear that story. It's beyond what I expected, and it's a fascinating life. And you know what? There's still so much of it as well, which is excellent. So what we do at the end, we just ask some simple little silly questions to everybody just to get their reaction. So I'll just ask these little questions, and Jack will have a couple as well. So the first one is, how would you explain your job to a five-year-old?
I get up on a stage and sing songs and act like a silly person.
Yeah, there we go. Very nice.
And I think that's what we would say as well.
Yeah, it's something like that, isn't it? Yeah, show off professionally. And what? How do you have your tea?
My tea.
How do you take your tea?
A little bit of milk. That's it.
Wow. There we go.
Knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
My advice would be to learn more instruments a lot younger.
Learn more instruments. That's interesting. Most people say, you know, take lessons or study one instrument to a higher level, but you're saying more instruments.
I'm all about the more. Right now I've got a bloody tenor guitar here, which I hate. I hate it. I hate it already. I can't make my fingers do the right shapes. F, you can forget about it.
In a film of your life, Ali, who would play you?
Yes.
Oh, I used to say Claire Danes. But, do you remember her?
I don't.
That shows my age a little bit. Claire Danes, because she's kind of got that right amount of crazy. You know what I mean? She's got a slightly crazy eye.
Now, that could be a song title. If
or an album title.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Band title. I think I should go write that down. Yeah.
Okay, so you're going with Claire Danes, are you? Fantastic.
Yeah, I'll go with Claire Danes.
Thank you, Ali, and I hope people enjoy this and find your website and see where you're playing back in when we get back to gigging more from this. And just thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this. It's been an absolute honor. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much.
I do have one more thing. I think it'd be nice to maybe come back and do. I'd like to hear a little bit more about your point of view as you know, women in jazz, and how you feel you're impacting that or other things. I think that would be a wider discussion. Maybe bring some other people in as well.
Yes, that's a great idea. In fact, when Danielle is back in town, we should, let's send a message about that.
Because on these podcast series, we do like to do take specialist subjects and bring multiple people in. So that would be a fantastic one. So let's set that up. Yeah, wonderful. Oh, wonderful. Well, look, we'll say goodbye now. And that'd be fantastic.
I'm going to run and buy some more wine before they cut off. I'm going to find you this. Fantastic. All right, my lovelies. I will speak to you soon. Thank you
very much, Ali. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Jack.
So there we go then, Jack. What did you think to that?
Yeah, fascinating story. Interesting to know. Yes, I think we said in the interview, she's had a different angle to come to this sort of thing than most of the interviews we've had. So it's been, interesting to learn that. And the American angle, the traveling stuff. It's, interesting.
I think she, you know, like, she is a very, very, very interesting person that's led a very interesting life, and I didn't expect there to be as much as there was, and I know we didn't really cover so much of it, but there was so much that we talked about. So I found that fascinating, and it's you know, I really respected her and appreciated her before as this person that just turned up on the internet asking, you know, trying to reach out to us to do something for us. So do you know what? I think she's an amazing person. I think that's great that we could sort of talk to her and find out about who she is. That's been fascinating.
Yeah, as you said, I think it's good to, she's definitely someone that gets stuff done. She wants to have an idea and then try and follow through with it, whether it, how long it continues or it's not, I guess it's not about money. It's just about doing things, isn't it? So that's good. And I definitely want to get her back to talk about, yeah, women's place in jazz, I guess, or however we frame it. I think that would be a good topic of conversation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think we need to set up a specialist subject for one of the podcasts.
Yeah. More of an education, really. Yeah.
Yeah, well, like we are lining up some other ones at the moment to do with like resonator guitars and certain blues musicians and bringing world experts from around the world together. So women in jazz would be a fascinating one. I'd love to find out about that and what the situation is and try and maybe share that out so it might help people. So that would be good. Yeah. Good. Okay, well, yeah. Hey, it's been a long one, but a good one. So let's say goodbye and thank you for listening to the Washboard Resonators Presents. We'll see you later.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.